Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Technology Leaders.
Lee Cantor here with James Douglas, another episode of Atlanta Technology Leaders. And we've got a full house?
Yeah, it's packed in here.
Packed.
That's an English phrase for full.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Thanks for the translation. So who do you want to lead off with?
I think let's go with Lance.
We'll go with
Lance.
I'm used to the other pronunciation because I actually spent some time in the UK when I'm back at university days, as you call it there.
There you go.
Yeah.
All right, Lance Gleason, and you're with Attendalytics.
That is correct.
Brought with you your good friend Nathan.
That's correct, yes.
Who we don't like to mention his last name. So why don't you tell us a little bit about Attendalytics? What are you guys up to?
So basically what Attendalytics is it's a it's designed for people that are organizing conferences or something else like that. And the problem that we're solving is that if you're on the web, it's really easy to get metrics on your users where you have if you run a website, it's very easy to get metrics on how many visitors you've had, where they've come from, which parts of the website they visit, and so on with that. But when you get into the physical space, and in particular conferences, which is a space that I am very intimately familiar with as both a co-organizer on a couple of conferences, a speaker, and an attendee of them, most organizers today, they have to go kind of on a gut reaction as far as like how many people are attending which session, when you've got sponsor booths, which ones are getting better, are getting more people that are coming by them. And more importantly, even beyond that, is who's visiting them. And so the idea with Attendalytics is we basically, using some wireless technology, we've come up with a way to be able to actually allow an organizer to get that, basically those metrics to be able to track where they're going in the center and so on with that. And so it's
So you're using like some sort of mobile technology?
Yes.
What?
Specifically, we're using beacon technology.
So that'll tie to like a wristband or something on my badge? How does it work?
Right. It will be badge-based is what it actually, the way it works.
And the kind of information that it would give would be different depending on whether you're an attendee or whether you were a sponsor?
Well, so the first audience with this is more for the organizers and then breaking that out into the sponsors as well. Because the idea with it is that the thing is you can – long-term, there are a lot of opportunities to be able to do things for the attendees as well. But you have to – one of the biggest challenges with wearables is not so much of a technological issue as it is a human issue. And it's very carefully balancing because privacy concerns and opt-ins and different things like that. And those can also be difficult problems to solve because does the user even – quite often at a lot of conferences, and I'm going to use tech conferences as an example, where you have people that are not afraid of technology – if you look at the aggregate numbers of people that download conference apps, it's actually not that large. And so the thing is, it's like, how do you drive that engagement? And I think that's a much more difficult problem, and yet there's a lot of lower-hanging fruit that can we
so
can
what is
first.
That percentage of people who download the app, even at tech conferences?
I would say, from what I've seen, if you're getting 50%, you're doing really well.
And that's in a conference that technology people are at, so those would be the most likely people to download the app, you think.
Right. And the thing is that there's a much bigger value add beyond that anyways, because as an organizer, for example, the ones that have more staff, they will have something like you'll have people that are out and counting or attempting to count how many people are in a session. And they might be saying, okay, it looks like we have maybe more beginners. Like if you're at I'm going to use a tech conference as an example, but it may not be the only one. But if we have like a bunch of beginners at this one session versus a lot of more advanced people at another. But they really don't have any way to quantify that data.
It's just people kind of eyeballing it.
Exactly. And that's if you have somebody that's covering every single track, but quite often, in fact, you don't even have that.
And it's not even just the number of people in that session. I think, am I understanding right, that it would understand who that person is? So you could say 80% of this audience is an advanced CEO, or 10% is a sales level entry. Is that basically where we're going with this?
Yes. Yep.
And would you know the name of the person? Like you could identify them to that regard?
You could. I'm gonna say that though, being very cautious. And with that being basically the issue that you run into in general with any of that is again privacy. And so we're taking the conservative approach first, where let's do anonymized data where we can correlate it with information about the user, but not necessarily personally identifiable. And then we'll back into the other as kind of appropriate after we figured out some of these other issues. Because
right.
It's my experience, even with tech-savvy people, that you get a lot of concern with that. And, I mean, if you look at it, I'm a big Glass user, and yet we know about places that just ban the use of the device because, oh, my God, you have a camera on your face. Whoa, what are you going to do? And it's – I'm not taking photos of everybody. I can't be bothered with it, but there's that – That's a human issue, right? It's not a technological issue. It's a human issue. And that's part of what we need to solve and basically get more pilots under our belt to sort of determine what the best approach is with that.
Now, can you talk a little bit about how you guys were formed?
Sure. So basically, the way it came about was this thing called Startup Weekend. And for those that are not familiar with that, that's basically... It was originally founded by the Kauffman Foundation. I think now they call it Up Global, if I'm not mistaken. And I kind of have a nice long history with that myself because my first startup that I had was founded at another Startup Weekend. And that was actually what got me really deeply involved in the startup community. But the format of it is, in essence, you have a bunch of people that get out there and they try to balance the attendee list so that you have a certain number of business people, a certain number of tech people, and so on. Ideas are pitched, and it's a fairly free-form way. And then as a group, you collectively vote on various ideas until you kind of come up with a rough group consensus of these are some teams that are more popular, and then groups go off and they form and they create the idea over a weekend. And so we went to one of those, and I basically pitched this idea. And it generated a lot of interest. And before I knew it, I had this big team. And then on top of that, too, we had one team that was initially our team was smaller, but then another one decided they didn't have enough traction. And so we ended up with this fairly large team. And Attendalytics was kind of born out of that.
So now when you're doing that, you went in there just by yourself as an individual with an idea. And then this group kind of formed around the idea?
Yes. That was
so exactly. You had no like partner in this or anybody ahead of time that you thought would...
Nope.
And Lance, I had you describe before we went on air saying that you were the hacker and that Nathan is the hustler, which is a great introduction to anyone. So perhaps it would be good to bring in Nathan on this and just say, what qualifies you as a hustler?
Well, I think creativity in figuring out ways to get exposure, to get potential customers and get our product out in the marketplace.
And if we have anyone listening who's in the event space, what kind of messaging, what kind of hooks would you want them to be listening to right now thinking this could be great for us?
Well, I think if you want to make your conference just incredible, you need to know what's going on, what's important to your users, and really who your most engaged users are. And so that's what Attendalytics is really out to do, is to give you insights from that data that you can't physically observe. You can't stand everywhere in the conference at all times and observe exactly what's going on. And so that's really the value that we bring, is those insights into what are we going to do next year from a content perspective, from a logistical perspective.
And is this the first idea that you've kind of joined, or is this just the latest one?
When I was in grad school, I went to Georgia Tech, went back to Georgia Tech a second time to get my MBA, and did the Georgia Tech business plan competition and formed a team with a couple buddies. And we were just doing it part time and just kind of fizzled out over time. But learned a heck of a lot and ended up in the corporate world, which I work at Equifax. Great company. Great team, but I'm enthralled with the idea of a startup and building something from nothing. And I went to Startup Weekend looking for kind of a way to do that, and found Lance, found this team. I mean, it's an incredible team we've got. I mean, it's like a miniature corporation almost, just strengths abiding. So
fantastic.
Or abounding, sorry.
So now what's next for you guys? Is the product ready to go? Like you beta tested this at an event?
No, that's actually so. Basically, our next phase is to start to pilot this with live customers, because it's one thing to build a prototype that you can kind of play around with over a startup weekend, but I think it's another to have something that's really ready to go at a conference venue. That's a bit more of an effort. And our primary focus is really right now developing a great product and seeing what actual users' reactions are to it and figuring out those things and kind of taking it from there.
So you're looking for an event to pilot? Or you already have some?
Oh, we actually have some of those. That's the nice thing about it. It's pretty easy. The one nice thing about this is that it's not like we have to do a hard sell on somebody to be like, to try it out. Now, when we get to our revenue model, obviously that'll be something else. But as far as like showing the value and showing, hey, this would be pretty neat, it's not difficult to convince somebody, hey, can we try this out? Can we try this at your event?
Right.
Yeah. And what kind of timelines are you looking?
Q1 of next year.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so Lance runs a Ruby conference in South Africa called Ruby Fuse.
Yep, Ruby Fusa, yes.
Now that's got a story behind it.
Well, it's kind of interesting because it's the only Ruby conference in South Africa. And actually for a number of years, I first spoke at that conference back in 2012. And just got really involved in that. My business partner with my consulting company, she actually is from there. And just over the years, after speaking for 3 years and then helping to organize one of their unconferences this past September, kind of decided that we wanted to give some new blood a chance to speak. And so I said, well, you know, what the heck? I'll volunteer and help be one of the co-organizers. And so we've kind of expanded out the committee from what it was initially. And yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So now what do you need more of?
Basically, I think right now probably – certainly tech people. I mean, that's always probably the biggest thing, if anything. And beyond that, just, I don't know. I mean, I think that we're pretty much, it's just us getting down to getting some pilots out.
So getting some pilots out, and that should happen at the beginning of next year.
Yeah.
Oh, we wish you every success. It sounds like a fantastic idea.
Yeah.
All right. And then the website for you guys?
It's attendalytics.co. So attendalytics.co.
All right. Great job, guys.
Thank you.
Great.
Who do you want to do next?
I think let's go with
Mr. Harris.
I think we should.
Todd Harris, Hi-Rez Studios. Welcome.
Hey, guys. It's good to be here.
So what did you think of that last crowd?
That was pretty cool. We've done a few events that are gaming related, so I could see that there'd definitely be a use for that sort of analytics.
So Hi-Rez Studios, what are you guys doing for folks?
So we make online games. You know, we bring the fun.
There you go.
We're 150 people now up in Alpharetta. We've been at this for 10 years now, and most recent games really fueled a lot of growth for us. But basically, they are online multiplayer games where people play with and against others all over the globe in various fantastical universes.
So now, how'd you get involved in the gaming universe yourself?
Really passion. I mean, I'm 46, so I'm right on the edge of, you know.
They let you play, the young kids?
They do. They beat me badly, my skills. My son beats me.
So I've got to interrupt here. What was the first computer console you ever played with?
The Magnavox Odyssey 2. You played Pong. You hooked it up to your TV. It did not have digital scoring. When I scored a point on you, I took a physical peg on the Magnavox and moved it.
And how long did it take to load up?
It was pretty fast to load. That was its one and only redeeming quality, actually, as a console, was speed of loading, but pretty simple in gameplay.
I think I had a ZX Spectrum. I don't know what you call it here in America, but it took 45 minutes to load this cassette. And then if you wanted to play the game on this other side, you had to load the first game, turn the cassette over, and then spend 45 minutes loading the second game.
Did the same thing on Apple II. But actually, my father was an IBMer for 30 years, and we were fortunate because when the PC came out, they actually had a lottery of all the employees, and he drew one of the lucky numbers. So we had one of the very first batches of IBM personal computers back when I was in about 7th, 8th grade. And so I taught myself to program. There were no games available for the platform, and that's what I wanted to do was program games one day. And I got on a slightly different path, did business software at other startups here in the Atlanta area, but it took 15 years, but eventually I got back to gaming.
So now, what's the Atlanta gaming market look like? Is it pretty robust?
It's an interesting market. It's definitely emerging as far as developers. The state actually is really supportive of the industry, which you don't always find. But because of the universities here like Georgia Tech, Savannah College of Art and Design, really we have top five universities, and the state wants to keep that talent here. So underneath the entertainment tax credit that covers film, it also covers video games. So they're actively courting game developers in the area, and that's allowed us to keep a lot of our jobs here locally. And,
right, we've seen a lot of the growth in the film business because of that tax credit, so it's also impacted the gaming industry as well?
It has, not to the same extent yet, but I think over time we'll continue to see it. So we're, again, at 150. We're one of the larger game companies in the Southeast now. There's a couple other companies that are at the around 75 employee level here in the area. And then if you go down to the startup level, you know, today with mobile games and digital distribution, one guy or girl, you know, in their basement can code right. a mobile game. And so if you go down to kind of that level of garage team bands developing games, you'll have about 50 companies in the area that are going after that.
Sorry, Todd, question. When you look at mobile apps, there's a real failure rate that's fairly high is with these kind of things. What does it look like for games? If you're putting out a game, is it higher or lower than the average mobile app in terms of success?
It's a very hit-driven business across all platforms, even more so with mobile. But in the downloadable space that we operate in, so our current games to date have been only on the Windows PC. We are moving into other platforms. And so on the Windows PC, most games fail before they ship. Those that ship, 80% will lose money, and then the winners will win incredibly big. On mobile, it's probably more like 95% don't make money. The winners actually can win even bigger, though, because the number of deployed units with mobile and tablet is so high. So it's a very hit-driven business. It takes a combination of awesome gameplay, luck, and timing to get a hit. Fortunately, you know, for our own game on the PC, after two tries, we're kind of improving and learning as we go, and our third game, Smite, is finding really good traction.
So now, how do you decide which platform to go for?
We started with PC because when we started the company in 2005, we saw that digital was going to be a very disruptive force in the industry. At that time, most games were bought at a retail store. But we saw that digital was going to impact. And so from the beginning, we set up our studio to embrace digital distribution so that we wouldn't have to go through a publisher, through a retailer, and we could go directly to our end user over the internet. Mm-hmm. And we were pretty early adopters of that. And the PC at that time was the best platform for that. There were digital distribution tools available. You could market over the web and then later through social tools such as YouTube, Facebook, et cetera. Right. And now other platforms are catching up, including the next generation of consoles, the Xbox One and PlayStation 4. Digital is starting to be a larger percentage of their revenue, which is why we're actually going to be moving to those platforms in addition to mobile. But we started with PC basically because we could own our destiny and communicate and sell directly to the end user on that platform.
How does YouTube come into play with gaming?
For us, it's huge. I mean, gaming has actually just recently overtaken music to be the most viewed content on YouTube. And if you look at the top 10 YouTubers as far as subscribers, the majority of them are game channels. The number one YouTuber in the world, a guy by the name of PewDiePie.
Sorry, say that again?
Is a gentleman by the name of PewDiePie.
He PewDiePie. Makes,
PewDiePie. PewDiePie. Yes. PewDiePie. Yep. Yeah, Swedish gentleman.
Look that up.
He has over 70 million subscribers. He makes millions of dollars just by people watching his videos, and he monetizes them through advertising, and all of his content is game related.
And
he's,
like,
he's
share,
played our game a few
share,
times, by the way.
Share what happens when you're watching one of his videos.
The video content varies a lot. His specialty is actually the horror genre. So he'll play through a more narrative horror-based game, and he really made a name for himself because his reactions to being scared while he plays these games were so over the top that he was basically creating his own form of
theater.
Theater, exactly. Wow.
So it's voyeuristic, but the person's watching to learn the tricks to get through the levels.
That's right. In his case, they're watching because he does over-the-top reactions.
Sounds like he's crying.
That's right. But most gaming content, there's a category that's humor, but most, as you said, is really people who want to learn. You know, if you are a basketball player and you had a chance to watch Michael Jordan, LeBron James play and practice at their home court, and you could also leave them comments and every once in a while get response on those comments. That's what the platform of YouTube for video on demand and Twitch for live streaming with interactive chat, that delivers that to gamers. And there's a lot more gamers today than basketball players, for good or bad. And so the platform is really kind of exploding this whole scene of not only playing games, but viewing games as a spectator sport.
Now, the revenue for gaming is astonishing, isn't it? It's much larger than most people realize.
It is. I mean, you know, you'll see estimates of around $80 billion globally. It clearly exceeds the box office as far as revenue, and this year most likely will exceed the film industry overall. It's certainly
at that same events? Level.
Sporting events, as far as revenue, sporting events are very high, but visibility and viewability, gaming is starting to exceed that. So some of these tournaments where people are actually playing video games competitively, there was one held recently for the number one game in the category, League of Legends, kind of a competitor of ours in the space. They had last year's World Tournament, people playing this game competitively in the Staples Center, which they sold out in 1 hour. Their most recent tournament was in Seoul, Korea, where they sold out a soccer stadium of 40,000 people. The second game in the category is called Dota 2. They recently had an event in Madison Square Garden that was very successful. And the third game in the category is our own, Smite, and we'll be having a tournament coming up in Atlanta in January.
Oh, so we'll see what crowds we pull here, huh?
We will sell out Cobb Energy Center for sure. And
how quickly? Let's go for a prediction here.
I'm not going to predict the sellout, but I will tell you that we have an interesting model for the prize for that tournament. So these are teams that have been playing this game.
Do they get to meet Thor?
For years. They will meet someone who is dressed as Thor and has an excellent Norse accent. And the way we funded the prize pool is actually selling items within the game. So between $2 and $10 purchases, where we've told the community, if you buy this particular set of items, we will donate a portion to the prize pool. The prize for the event that will happen in January, when I left this morning, was $1.8 million.
And where do I register?
You're a couple years too late.
Wow.
So now that event, if somebody wanted to learn more about it, where is that?
Yeah, well, our general website is smitegame.com. The name of the game is Smite. And on that website, they can look at tickets to the event and also see a running counter of the prize pool, see all the teams that are participating. And, of course, the game is free, so they can also download the game and play if they have a Windows PC.
And then the way that you guys monetize is by selling stuff within the game?
It is. It's all in-game transactions. So if you really like Thor and you want to have an outfit for Thor where he's dressed as a heavy metal rocker and you want to show that your Thor looks a little different, then that's an optional transaction you can make. So our philosophy is actually everything that affects the core game itself, you can earn just by playing the game. If you want to get it a little faster, it's a time or money trade-off. But a lot of our revenue is purely cosmetics. It's virtual items that give you more status and prestige in the world because you spend a lot of time there. And in the same way you want a nice-looking basketball jersey or, you know, fancier-looking bag for your golf clubs, you know, people invest enough time in these that they do want to make these optional purchases. And that's our entire revenue model, basically.
And how many people play Smite?
So we released the game in March of this year, and our registered accounts are well over 5 million on a monthly basis. We have over 1 million people playing actively.
So at any given time?
Yeah. So at any given time, on a daily basis, we're probably around a 60,000 kind of count.
And I'm sorry, how long did the average person play?
Average is really tough to say because some people will try it and it's just not for them, and many people will play 6 months or beyond.
Okay, for those that are your kind of core fan base, is it like 1 hour, 5 hours?
Oh, I got you, per day.
Yeah.
per day, they're probably playing over an hour. A match within the game of Smite ranges between 15 minutes if you choose a fast game mode to about an hour if you choose a more intense game mode. So most people will play between, let's say, 1 and 2 hours.
Wow. Wow. Good stuff. So once again, if somebody wanted to learn more, Smite.
Yeah, they just visit us at smitegame.com. They can download the game. They can see all the crazy YouTube videos we use to give the community a glimpse into how the game is made. And yeah, we love to have
and
more players check it out.
What about if they wanted to connect with you or locally? Maybe they're somebody who wants to get into gaming or involved in gaming. Are you part of the gaming development community?
Very much so, yeah. There's an Independent Game Developers Association that's active here in Georgia, and also a GGDA that's a group of companies. So yeah, they can get in touch with me, probably Twitter at Todd Allen Harris. Of course, they can hit me up on LinkedIn as well. And happy to talk with folks who are, definitely want to grow the scene here in Atlanta. There's a lot of creative talent and technical talent here, and games should be an even bigger industry here, and I think it will be.
And you're probably always looking for talent, huh?
We are indeed.
Never ends.
Never enough.
All right. Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for being part of the show.
Thanks very much.
All right. Next up, we have our friends from Stable Kernel. Do you know that, James?
I do now.
So now you're going to help me with his name?
I don't know if I'm the best qualified.
All right. I think it is Brian Harper.
Yes.
Yes, I win. There you go. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Got to get a lot closer to the microphone.
Am I in there?
There you go. All right. So you're the... Director of Design, Stable Kernel. Can you share a little bit about what you guys are up to?
That's correct. I started at Stable Kernel last week as the Director of Design.
Wow, congratulations.
Thank you.
What a great way to celebrate your first week anniversary.
Doesn't get better than this. This is the pinnacle.
This is part of their training program, you know. They put you on the air.
Every new hire will have to come through.
Exactly. So what is Stable Kernel doing for folks?
We make iOS and Android apps.
What about games? I know a guy in the gaming industry.
We don't make games, but funny enough, I used to work in the game industry in Atlanta, and that's where I got my start. And I think there's a lot of overlap between gaming and interactive app design these days.
All right, so share a little bit about interactive app design. What's good and what's bad?
That's such a loaded question, but I'll give it a shot. I like design that's... I'm going to use some buzzwords of clean, minimal. That's really hot these days. Flat. But at the core of that, it's app design that is to the point, doesn't have a lot of unnecessary fluff around it.
And you don't want it to be an exact replica of the website, right? Is that
absolutely
a rookie mistake?
Yeah. There are a lot of unique things you can do with a native app. Obviously, the screen size is different. You're not using a mouse and keyboard typically on a mobile phone or tablet. So you have to take into consideration touch interfaces, gestures, what you can do on the screen, the unique capabilities of mobile devices such as cameras and microphones and whatnot. So yes, it should be a completely different experience. Obviously have the same brand guidelines and colors and be a consistent voice, but native apps are their own thing these days.
And is there anything that's particularly exciting you right now that you've noticed?
What excites me about native apps is just the range of different things that they can do, whether it's something that's seemingly mundane, like replacing a paper process that people used to do with, you know, physical snail mail or moving papers throughout an office. Enterprise apps are generally kind of boring, but they can actually be very useful to people and save people time and really eliminate a lot of tedious, redundant work. So that's exciting to me. On the other hand, there are brain training apps, photography apps, great social networks, communication apps that work across all platforms. And I can be on my laptop and then move to a smartphone and have the same experience and seamlessly transition there. So that sort of thing is exciting to me.
Could you share a little bit about what the process is if you're working with a new client or a new project? Are you trying to understand, like, what are some of the questions you ask to kind of get a feel for what their aesthetic is and what their, you know, the outcome they desire?
Sure. Talking to any client, I like to be a sponge at the beginning of that process and just absorb what their business goals are, what are they trying to accomplish with this app, who do they want to reach, and what do their users want out of an app? Maybe it's something that already exists and they want to streamline a process. Maybe it's something completely new and they need to prototype a whole bunch of different ideas. And that's where I'll come in and start creating prototypes, mock-ups, wireframes, and whatnot.
And then so you want to get a kind of a clear vision at that point before you start coding and doing permanent things.
Right, right. And hearing those business goals and knowing the core of what they're after really helps inform those design decisions later of, let's say we're going to do this color for this item. Being able to tie that back to a business goal of, well, we want to elevate this one call to action. That's more constructive than saying, well, I like the color blue, so I'm going to use it here.
Right.
So tying design decisions back to business goals is something that really benefits from having that requirements gathering session at the beginning.
And is there a particular question that you really rely on to help get the most out of a meeting with a client for the first time? Is there something that you'd say to them, look, before we meet up, this is the kind of thing I'd love you to be thinking about, or any advice on that side?
I always like to know what sort of apps clients enjoy using and what sort of apps they think look nice and appeal to them and their demographic. And then once they come in and I feel like I have a good handle on what they're going for, I like to get into interactive whiteboarding sessions and even throw Photoshop up on a TV and start iterating and workshopping design ideas directly with them and get that immediate feedback of, do you like this? Is this going in the right direction? Is this what's in your mind? Because it's really an idea of they have this vision for a product, and the way they communicate it is through, you know, business plans and PDFs and maybe some sketches. And I think it's my job to try to manifest that into something real or something they can look at and maybe touch an interactive prototype as quickly as possible.
Now, I would think that from your perspective, this elevating the design to this art form and the having the elegance of simplicity, that can really elevate a brand. And that you got to sometimes educate a customer that maybe isn't used to thinking of their brand in that manner. Do you have to sometimes kind of work through their expectations of what can and can't be done?
Absolutely. They're tough decisions that have to be made, and often I'll make a recommendation that is new for a company that might be used to doing things on the desktop web,
right,
for example, and they want to put everything on one page, or maybe they're used to print where everything's static and it can't move and there's no dynamic data in there. So helping those clients transition into a world where data can change at any minute, users can input their own data, they can be on any range of devices between watches, phones, tablets, computers, and helping them create a system that works across all of those is sometimes a hurdle. Sometimes that's what they come to us for.
Can you share maybe a success story, how you were able to kind of do something transformative for a client?
Sure. There have only been a few instances in the last week that I've been at Stanley Carroll.
Well, it could be a past life.
Sure. I won't name any names, I guess, but we've done, enterprise apps and apps for service people that come to people's houses, and they used to fill out a lot of forms and everything, and that was all print-driven. If they needed an extra field on a form, they have to go get a new form, put that in there.
Right.
The power of computers and iPads and iPhones is that we could have this dynamic form that they could bring to their user. Depending on what they need, they can fill it out however they want. They can add photos in there that they took with the iPad. And that sort of experience, I think, really elevates a full suite of businesses.
Right. It elevates the level of service that person is providing to the customer.
Absolutely.
So now, what's next for you guys? What are you guys looking forward to in 2015?
Well, we're continuing to grow, continuing to bring on new clients in all sorts of fields, iOS, Android. Probably see a lot more watch apps come out with Android Wear and the new Apple Watch. That's exciting. And just continuing to create high quality apps for iOS and Android.
Now, do you have an industry you guys serve more than others? Or?
It's really all over the place. Oddly enough, right now, it's natural foods and home automation. They just go hand in hand.
Yes. So natural foods, like a person who sells like organic?
Sure, yeah, like a supply line, natural foods, and retailers.
Good stuff. So if somebody wanted to learn more, website for you guys?
They would go to stablekernel.com or find us on Twitter at stablekernel.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being part of the show.
Thanks for having me.
James.
Yes.
It's our headliner.
It is.
Adam Wexler with Inside Pool. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, don't hurt yourself, man. All right, Inside Pool.
Been a busy time. Very busy in the last few months, it seems.
Yes, it has.
Lots of congratulations in order.
Thank you.
I think you graduated from Tech Village this week.
Yeah, last week.
That means they kick you out, right?
We outgrew the place.
Yeah, we'll call it that. So what? So what's been happening? So why the growth and you got to graduate?
Yeah, well, I'll kind of take a rewind to last fall in I think it was August of 2013. We were still six people. I think that was around the time when I was doing this show, maybe a year and a half ago. By September, we had just about doubled. Doubled meant, you know, 11 people.
Right.
And now we're over 50. So it's been moving quick. It's been a fun ride. And, you know, there's a lot more to come in 2015.
So now you guys are the leader in social engagement activation. Can you talk a little bit about what that means?
So... Interestingly enough, we've always struggled with our tagline, and I think that
it's a mouthful.
It often comes with the territory of kind of pioneering a category. Mm-hmm. We're still trying to define exactly what that is. So rather than focusing exactly on that title, I think it'd be better if I just kind of described what it is that we do. You know, so for some of the world's leading brands, whether it be Coca-Cola, Home Depot, Cox Communications on a local level, or Warner Brothers, General Mills, name it, on a much broader national level, we're helping all these guys basically scale their social outreach and basically drive the bottom line results through social media.
And then, so how does that happen?
So, you know, our process is primarily twofold. We basically help all these brands go out and identify all of the individuals of interest depending on what they're trying to accomplish. And once we identify the audience segments of greatest relevance, we basically allow them to do one-to-one outreach in a very proactive fashion. So rather than just, you know, combing the streams and waiting for people to just say stuff of interest, we literally go out and mine the interest graph and gather information about these individuals, whether they're saying anything or not. And then we allow them to deliver these very personalized messages at scale. That resonate.
But you're able to identify who the key constituents of a given brand are?
You know, a number of the campaigns are influencer related, so mm-hmm. it's primarily oriented towards mass reach. And then on the other hand, you know, especially in the B2B market, it's often very direct to the prospect. So you know, they're trying to push them down the funnel or pull them into the funnel in the first place. So that's why, you know, we're pioneering, you know, phrases like social drip marketing, taking what, you know, the likes of Pardot and many others, especially in this town, Silverpop, another one, have done through email marketing. And we're taking a lot of those same techniques and just applying them to social.
And the idea is more about tags and identifying people rather than suggesting content.
In terms of what Insightful does?
Yeah.
You know, I think it goes both ways. So, you know, you have to start by identifying the audience segments, and then it's a matter of, you know, figuring out what's going to resonate with them, the most.
Wow.
So now how do you, okay, so you're a B2B company and you want to reach, CFOs. So you just have a list of CFOs that are on Twitter, and
so
you just start going, "Hey, Mr. CFO,
yeah, so
pay attention to me."
So
fantastic example that was insightful.
Insightful is a good word with us. At the moment, you know, we're primarily built on top of Twitter. We'll quickly be expanding in the new year to include Instagram and Pinterest, among others. But, you know, take Twitter, for example. They've got over 284 million active users. You know, most of the folks out there, most of the other software solutions are strictly focused on kind of what people are saying, as I kind of alluded to before, whereas we literally can comb all 284 million plus, whether or not they're saying anything. And what's ironic is that the large majority of the individuals that are active on the platform don't even say a word. They're just lurking. So
how do you define active if they're not?
And that's not necessarily my definition. Active is literally logging in. And just, you know,
so you've logged in, so you may not ever tweet.
Exactly.
But you could be active.
More than 50% don't tweet.
Than 50 out of the 284 million.
More than 50% don't tweet. They treat it as the 21st century newspapers, how I would
say. So they're just like scrolling down people that are interesting in reading.
Exactly.
And they may go to links, though, that are within the tweet or.
Well, you know, one of the things that we take advantage of, and I'm showing you this, but nobody can see it, is, you know, I think the stat is over 70% of people keep their mobile social notifications turned on. So basically, from these brands, through our system, they basically do this individual outreach. So all of a sudden, you'll get that notification from Home Depot saying, you know, hey, Bobby, noticed you're a big DIYer. Thought you might be interested in this 20% off, you know, deal we have going on right now.
So Home Depot can do that with somebody that just maybe is interested or has never said a word about
this. I think the easiest way to kind of put it in perspective is, you know, take what they're currently doing from a, you know, they've got these different campaigns ongoing at the same time. And they're pushing these out on across different channels. And specifically on Twitter, you know, they've got to consolidate that message into 140 characters. Well, you know, they basically push it out. And despite, you know, so many of these brands having, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions of followers, the type of engagement they get is, you know, insignificant, basically. But if you basically just take that same content and drive it towards the audience segment that actually would care, and personalize those messages, rather than this being just, you know, another tweet that gets, you know, flushed through the rest of the stream, they're actually going to be receptive and they're going to, you know, actually perk up at the fact that this brand, I mean, there's something that we like to call social currency, that happens when, you know, it's one thing for a brand to communicate with you via email. You're not going to get very excited about that. In fact, you'll probably just trash that. But if a brand actually communicates with you over social, all of a sudden there's something, you know, in that there's that dopamine loop that takes place. It's a psychological thing which we're actually studying, that really we're taking advantage of right now.
And then so then they can make an offer or they can move them to like a coupon or some type of engagement.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I think it's always important to start with the goal in mind. So every campaign, you know, has a goal, whether that goal is to get this audience segment to rebroadcast it to the rest of their audience, whether that is trying to drive X number of clicks, actual redemptions. I mean, the list goes on and on. But I would honestly advocate for, and I believe I threw this phrase out there a minute ago, this notion of social drip marketing. I think so many of these brands, for example, I'm actually in the midst of looking into cars, new cars, and you know, take a cycle like that. That does not happen overnight.
Right.
So if a brand's trying to make an impression with me, they need to basically engage me over the course of time, and they don't need to come at me with a hard sell right off the bat,
right,
or else I'm going to be turned away. So literally, it's a matter of, you know, engaging with them, staying top of mind, and often kind of, you know, giving before you get. And then once you've warmed them up enough, then you kind of go in for the kill. And, you know, they're going to be that much more receptive.
And how does it work with so much of social media being about brands technically by their buying power shouting at customers, here's our, you know, product or here's our service? How does smaller brands who don't have the same amount of money compete in such a packed marketplace?
I think it's a great question. And honestly, that's why one of the reasons that Insightpool exists, you know, I will say that, you know, our price point started, you know, $2,000 a month, basically. But, you know, even for some of these smaller brands that they don't necessarily have to be the Fortune 500s, you know, it's so difficult to, you know, develop organically an audience in this day and age. It's so noisy out there, to your point. So our whole mentality is you have to be proactive. You can't just tweet to tweet or post to post. People aren't just going to, you know, come around in bulk. So you literally need to go out most beautiful thing about social media is that all of these people have gathered online and you have the ability to go access them, but you can't just sit back and wait for them to find you. You've got to go find them.
So now if you're talking to a Home Depot and you're going after these do-it-yourselfers, you help them. I would assume most of them already are friends of Home Depot.
They don't necessarily have to be.
But you have to identify the segment that they're interested in engaging with, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'll give you a perfect example. So, so I'm actually consulting with the Atlanta Hawks right now on the side. And they were actually, prior to that, they were a client of Insightful. They still are. And they had this opening night. They had T.I. performing at the halftime show. Or actually, he performed pre, during, and post game. And so, essentially, their campaign leading up to opening night was centered around Atlanta Hawks fans that also doubled as hip hop fans.
Right.
Or maybe even vice versa, hip hop fans that potentially were Hawks fans that maybe weren't just following the brand. So through our system, through Insightful, that is, the Hawks were basically outreaching to people that weren't even, a part of their existing audience, but they knew that loved hip hop and liked basketball, and hoping that if they had that, mutual desire, they could basically be interested in the opening night ticket package.
And then, so then that subset would be get a message that said, hey, check out T.I. at the Hawks game.
Yeah, I mean, something along those lines.
Right.
And so a lot of it's about
optimized fashion.
but there's the profiling side of things. But you can know the right person to talk to. But if you're talking to them in the wrong way, you'll just annoy them and push them away. Mm-hmm. So do you help with that side of things?
100%. Okay. So, another common phrase that we float around is social predictive analytics. So literally we're studying over 60 variables to determine how receptive these individuals are going to be. And then we're also A-B testing the messaging over time. So we have a whole client services team that more often than not does the work on behalf of our clients, because so many of these organizations, they're staffing up social media, more and more every year, but they're still not fully caught up to solutions even before Insightful comes into the mix. And then we're a brand new solution and they don't have a dedicated resource for that. So we made a conscious decision. I think that was a large part of our growth and allowing us to retain a lot of our clientele, was because we would offer to do the work on their behalf. And that really, we're the masters, of our own software. So, and we've seen across a wide variety of clients what works and what doesn't. We're sitting on all that data right now. So we've got a whole data science team that's emerged and literally crunching all those numbers to figure out actually what resonates.
So when you first went to market, it was, here's this great tool that you can use and it can do lots of different things. And then you were getting an okay response from that. But then you said, hey, we'll do it for you. And then that's what kind of ratcheted up your... Growth.
Oh yeah, that was the huge catalyst for us. Because it's a win-win, right?
No one could do it better than you, right? You guys know it inside and out.
Exactly. So putting it in their hands was a little unrealistic, and I think that's the case with a lot of like new software, that especially ones that require time and dedication. I think that was a very wise decision on our part.
Come to that? Because that seems like at first, a lot of people, like you said, they build software to build software, and then they let the user use it how they're going to use it. And you decided, we're going to take a more hands-on approach, and we're going to really implement this on their behalf. And that's trust on their part, because you're going out to the market as them for all practical purposes in a lot of areas. So they have to trust that you're not going to...
Yeah, honestly, I found it a bit surprising that some of the biggest brands in the world were allowing us to essentially, be them.
Right. Was that your idea? Or board of advisors?
Would I take full credit for that. I think that was a collaborative decision. But I'll tell you, to answer your initial question, I think one of the biggest things that stood out in terms of building out the conscious decision to build out that client services team was when you start to see certain clients, churn. You got to figure out exactly why they're churning. Right. And it was not they were so excited on the front end. But what we come to find out is that they're just not logging in enough. They're not using it enough. And if you're not using it enough, you're not going to see enough value to make a $2,000 payment plus, justifiable.
So now when you did this client services, was that like a super premium thing now, or you just made it incremental? So then
we built that into the cost of, the monthly subscription. So, it's not.
So now there's a level of.
Exactly. Level of service.
Now at any. No matter what,
we have a couple different price points. Every price point includes a level of service.
Is there one bit of advice you'd give to someone that's new who maybe thinks they're doing quite a good job? They're not doing a great job, but they're doing a good job. Is there one question or one bit of advice that you would give them that would show the difference that you guys could make?
Just in terms of
phrasing? Is there some obvious low hanging fruit? If you said this way, you would go up 30% without even what the offer was.
That's a tough question. We're talking specifics now. You know, I can't think of anything.
Well,
a great example.
We'll take it more general than that. Is there any advice?
If you use blue instead of red, is that what you want to know?
Yeah, is there any kind of obvious things that in the industry, when you can see the data, there's some really clear, obvious kind of...
You know, we're studying... I mean, I'll just give you examples of the variables that we're studying. Like, we're studying everything from, you know, how long your bio is to what color the background is in your profile picture. So it's going pretty deep in terms of, you know, the types of variables that we're looking into to figure out exactly, you know, who's going to be more receptive than others.
And so, but you're going in with the mentality of we're testing everything, right? Or as many things as you can possibly test.
Absolutely.
So then you're A-B testing constantly, and one thing becomes king of the hill until something else knocks it off.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And what's great is we have such a wide variety of clientele these days that literally, you know, one type of messaging is not going to work in another vertical. So,
right.
You know, we just have to be extremely conscious of kind of, you know, who the brand is and kind of who they're trying to talk to.
Now, in this world that we live in, especially here in Atlanta, where there's so much marketing automation and everybody is now just content, how are they, are you finding the same challenges where that everybody's asking for content, but then nobody knows how to implement it properly to get the most out of it?
Yeah, I started to touch on this earlier. My whole thought is, you know, take what you're already basically publishing. Like, these people spend a lot of time, you know, crafting the ideal tweet. It gets pushed out, published, and then it gets, you know, extremely minimal, you know, results. So literally my thought process is, why can't we basically extend the life of that content and just drive it towards the most receptive, you know, audience segments, in a personalized fashion. So you're getting basically, you know, more out of, you know, what you're basically, you know, putting together on the front end, where currently it gets published one time and then it's gone.
But is that a good strategy to publish it one time, even though it's a 24-hour cycle? I mean, does that make sense?
Not at all. But I also think that, you know, so many of these news feeds are so noisy that, you know, just publishing to the masses, you're only going to get a fraction to actually see it in the first place.
Right.
And then only a fraction of that fraction is actually going to, you know, take the desired action. So at the end of the day, it's a pretty insignificant number if you're strictly looking at it from a publishing standpoint. So we truly believe that the future, and, you know, we look forward to 2015, especially because we think a lot more emphasis from social is going to be focused on ROI. Mm-hmm. And once these marketers get pressured to deliver hard ROI, they're going to be that much more inclined to say, okay, we can't just keep doing what we're doing. We've got to go the extra mile. And the extra mile, at least the way we see it, is being proactive.
And then identifying, I'm going to send to James Douglas, so I'm going to add James Douglas and send him a specific message from me. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I mean it's a matter of making sure that these individuals, you know, feel valued, and once again, this is a new age. You know, this is not an advertisement that doesn't speak anything to me. Mm-hmm. This is literally saying, you know, my one of my favorite quotes from, you know, I was in the music business before I started in Insightpool, and one of my favorite quotes was Bruce Springsteen was once quoted saying, "You may call me the boss, but I work for the people." In a similar fashion, you know, these brands need to stop thinking that they're on a pedestal and that the fans are down there. Literally, it might be... It's flipped.
Right.
And especially, I mean, I think eventually, once you gather that rapport, then they can literally, you know, do whatever you want. You know, but you've got to build that trust first.
And for 2015, what do you guys got going on? Where are you moving to?
So we just moved to Piedmont Center. So literally 100 yards down the road.
Wow.
Didn't have enough time to move, you know, to a different part of town. We've got, you know, I believe it's a little over 5,000 square feet with the ability to knock down the entire floor.
If you have to, huh?
If we have to. So it's going to be, you know, an exciting year. And I, you know, at the beginning of the year, we were talking about when we were still, you know, in the low teens, we were talking about being 50 people, and I didn't necessarily know if I believed it.
Sky's the limit.
Yeah, and you know, in one of our original board meetings at the early part of this year, one of our investors said, I got three words of advice. He said, spend more money. So we kind of, you know, took it to heart.
Good stuff. So if somebody wanted to learn more, you guys work B2B, B2C, it doesn't matter, right?
Across the board. You know, I truly believe that we can help out so many organizations, you know, just trying to find, you know, the people that can help them thrive in business. And they're out there. You just got to really dig for them. And that's what we're here to do.
All right. And that's insightpool.com.
Yep.
All right. Thank you so much for being part of the show.
Appreciate it.
All right, this is Lee Cantor for James Douglas. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Tech Leaders.
Atlanta Technology Leaders is brought to you by Band of Coders. Band of Coders is a company of talented software developers who energize clients' projects and their development teams.